Welcome to the Far and Beyond podcast, hosted by the Contracts and Fiscal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. This podcast is for the federal government attorney navigating the complex intersection of acquisitions and fiscal law and policy. I am your host, Major Ellie Sewell.
And I'm Major Jason Floyd.
Today, we have two special guests with us to discuss Secretary of Defense versus Pratt & Whitney. First, we have Mr. Adam Cottle from the Army Office of General Counsel. Welcome back.
Good morning.
And we also have Ms. Dana Chase, who is a chief trial attorney of the Army at the Contract Litigation and IP Division. Thank you for coming.
Oh, thank you for having me.
We're here today to discuss the case, like Ellie said. We have these special guests here because not only do we get the perspective from Clip, from the sort of the horse's mouth, if you will, but we also get the attorney who worked on at least a piece of the case. Sir, why don't you start us off with what is this case all about?
Well, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
It feels like it.
That's what this case actually feels like. More specifically, 1987 in East Hartford, Connecticut. DCA attorney on her very first audit found an interesting issue in Pratt & Whitney's books. And that led to a lengthy litigation with a contracting officer's final decision in 1996, a ASBCA decision in 2001 ruling against the government, a Federal Circuit decision in 2003 reversing the ASBCA and ruling in favor of the government. And interestingly, for the first time and so far, I believe the only time, actually defining what a cost and a price is. And so something anyone who deals in FAR Part 30 or 31 should really go read that case for that reason alone. It's UTC versus Rumsfeld. It went back to the ASBCA. There was a decision in favor of the government on collateral estoppel in 2005, an additional contracting officer's final decision. And then 2006, the DCMA and Pratt & Whitney settled that case. Now, at the same time, there was a advanced practice agreement, APA is what they call it, that was signed. And to this day, there is still massive disagreement between DCMA and Pratt & Whitney about whether or not those agreements were together or separate. And the court recognized that this is a completely unsettled issue. But it moved forward. At some point, someone filed a complaint with the DOD IG, and the DOD IG looked at it, and there's an entire report on this settlement, and it has, DOD IG says a few things about it that are certainly worth reading for anyone who's interested in cost accounting and litigation. So in 2013, a new divisional administrative contracting officer reviewed this, reviewed the DOD IG complaint, the report that was filed, reviewed a new DCA audit, and determined, among other things, that the 2006 APA was not legal, that the contracting officer had in fact violated the FAR whenever she signed it. And that kicked off another round of litigation of not just the CAS 418 issue that was the subject matter of the DCA audit, but this very fundamental issue of whether or not the 2006 advanced practice agreement was in fact a legal agreement between the contracting officer and Pratt & Whitney. The ASBCA ruled in 2021 that it was in fact a legal agreement, that a contract is a contract. There was an offer, there was an acceptance, there was consideration, while acknowledging the DACO's concern that this agreement clearly did not comply with the FAR. It is, all parties actually agreed to that. That then went on appeal in 2023, was appealed, and the decision in that case from the Federal Circuit came out in December 5th, 2025, issued by Judge Dyke, who, interestingly, was the same decision who issued the decision in 2003, again, reversing the ASBCA this time as well, and saying, no, you really don't have this issue right, again, on this case that's been referred to as the Jarndyce versus Jarndyce of the acquisition world, which is from Charles Dickens' Bleak House, and a case that just dragged on forever. At this point, we're in year 39 of this dispute, and it is not likely to be settled anytime soon, and this has consumed multiple attorneys' careers, and many have joined the government and left the government in the time that this case has been going on.
There are people in the government that weren't born when this case started.
Yes.
Like you, Ellie?
Maybe.
But also, there are folks who will be studying it, for example, in the CAC later on this summer, that, you know, fresh out of law school, that weren't born either. I mean, this is a rather extremely long-running litigation. We talk about the A-12 litigation. This has beaten that in terms of the duration of it. And today, talking about this idea of what are the limits on a contracting officer's authority is actually a very crucial consideration for our contracts attorneys.
Yeah, so let's get to that if we can. So the reason why we're really here today is the, like you said, the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit issued its decision in 2025, and it really focused on whether or not the contracting officer had the authority to enter into that agreement. You talked about, you called it an APA or an advanced agreement under FAR Part 31. Can you tell me just generally what an advance agreement is?
Sure. So in FAR 31109 was the old FAR numbering. I actually don't remember the new under the Revolutionary FAR overhaul if there's a different numbering agreement under different numbering under it, but it's still there. It was a series of rules that how you'd enter into agreement between a contracting officer and a contractor for the treatment of certain costs that were not otherwise covered by the FAR, and where there are certain types of costs or certain practices where the FAR does not speak to, and rather than leaving it to resolution at a future date, the contracting officer and the contractor can enter into this advance agreement for the treatment of costs that says, for this duration and for this set of contracts, we are going to treat this particular set of costs this specific way. And that way it brings clarity to both sides. It allows everyone to understand specifically how that cost is going to be addressed and resolved. And that way you can hopefully avoid future litigation on it. And that's the purpose of an advance agreement, is to bring that certainty, allow businesses to make long-term decisions and not be worried about, well, is the government actually going to take this cost and declare it unallowable or not allocable to government contracts, and allows them to make those decisions and allows us to focus on actually moving forward and administering those contracts.
And for those that are listening to the podcast, if you're looking at the case, what the case called this agreement was a drag agreement. And this was because of the way that Pratt & Whitney set up their business with their various suppliers, because they had both commercial and also government suppliers. And so they tried to figure out how their cost would work in charging the government and trying to figure out also how to account for those commercial costs. So they had kind of an unconventional cost setup for the way that they did their business. And that created what they called this drag agreement, or this advanced cost agreement. So because of this and the agreement that they ended up, it was the how Pratt & Whitney was going to account for these costs from their suppliers and whether they were going to be accounted in their overhead costs or not.
So these were essentially indirect costs that they were trying to figure out whether to put in the pool on the base and then who to assign that to. It, like you talked about, this was uncertain at the time. And so they were trying to do this advanced agreement to say, hey, go ahead and do this. Whatever this was, right? Those drag costs either include or excluded. I think it was excluded.
Excluded, yes.
Yeah. And then going forward, we'll just say that we're not going to fight about that issue anymore. Is that right?
That is correct.
Yeah. So in this particular case, Pratt & Whitney, their military operations are separate from their commercial operations. And there is this constant tension, because the smaller the commercial operations are, the more the military operations pay their indirect costs. The larger commercial are, the more that they pay the indirect costs. And what sparked this issue in 1987 was these particular parts were being costed at for a penny each, and airplane parts don't cost a penny. And that's kind of how this all started off. And Pratt & Whitney has some very, the Federal Circuit calls it unconventional ways of accounting for various costs, because it's not just a simple case of buying a part. There's other costs involved, and one of them is this drag issue, which you can read the cases, all four of them, and you want to dig into what really drag is. It's kind of a bit of a complex accounting issue, but it's all based on Pratt & Whitney has these unusual arrangements that they're allowed to enter into as a business entity, and how those costs should be accounted for so the government pays a proportionate share of the indirect costs at Pratt & Whitney as a whole, and pays so proportional to the benefits that it receives from these investments.
So the agreement sounds good, right? This sounds like something we would like the government and the contractor to enter into. So what did the court find wrong?
So here what the court found wrong is that the contracting officer in entering into this agreement didn't follow the requirements in the FAR. Specifically, when you enter into these types of agreements, you're supposed to incorporate it into the contract, and you're supposed to have a set duration for these types of agreements. And what the court found was this agreement was not incorporated into the contract and there was no set duration. So therefore, there was a violation of the FAR, and contracting officers are not allowed to violate the FAR. So it was an unenforceable agreement, which causes chaos.
Yeah, specifically. So what we're dealing with here is FAR has shall. FAR 31109 says the contracting officer shall do the following. Okay, shall is mandatory. Shall means must. Must means is an imperative. It's non-discretionary. And that has all kinds of interesting implications here of whether or not, of where does that shall go to, and we can discuss kind of how this could have implications and impacts elsewhere. But in this specific case, you actually had several contracting officers being affected. So the way that these advance agreements worked for indirect costs, you have a divisional administrative contracting officer who's responsible for setting the rates of indirect cost. And they are responsible for taking care of this agreement. And they have to tell other contracting officers, this is when it applies to you. And because of the division of responsibilities, it's not, we don't just simply assume every advance agreement applies to every contractor. Someone is responsible for determining the scope of the application. Someone has to make the decision. You don't simply assume. And if a contract, if it's not identified somehow, it has no application. And that can actually cause a lot of chaos. And then also duration is a really important thing, because the only duration of comment of any note in here is that the contracting officer at the time did something that is actually prohibited by the FAR. She said that the cost counting practice that was at issue that we're trying to treat was in fact non-compliant with cost counting standard 418, but the cost impact was immaterial and the government reserved the right to take action in the future if it became material. So that's not in compliance with FAR Part 30, but also how is that a statement of duration? Because materiality is a subjective decision. The DACO could have come around the next day and said, I've now determined the cost impact is material. And there was actually, if you read the cases, DCAA at the time was arguing the cost impact was already material. And so there was this massive tension there. And that was one of the things the court identified and said, the CAS 418 matter, that materiality determination, that's not duration. You had to put in a specified period of time, something that lets everyone else know, this is how long this lasts. Does it last for a day, for a year, for 10 years? That is, these are mandatory provisions of FAR, non-discretionary. The KO cannot ignore them, but in this case, the DACO did. And that was, the court found a fatal flaw in this, in addition to this other issue of not following the mandatory procedures in FAR Part 30 for how you resolve a CAS non-compliance. So there were three specific issues in this advanced practice agreements and this drag agreement that were not in compliance with these mandatory provisions. And the court said, yeah, we understand that there should be finality to contracts, but even a contracting officer is bound by the FAR, which has some really interesting implications, Dana, in other contexts.
Yes. So when you have issues where you have a contracting officer not following the FAR, it's basically an illegal agreement, can't be enforced. So when you have litigation falling into those parameters, you'll have decisions here. And for those that have read the debate back and forth from the fallout of the Pratt & Whitney decision, you have the private bar basically saying, how can we trust any sort of settlement agreement again? How can we trust any sort of advanced agreement again if it can be determined that it is in violation of FAR and shouldn't be followed, can't be followed? How are we going to be able to account for these indirect costs? How are we going to be able to trust that the agreement that we entered into yesterday will still be enforced tomorrow? So there's two different sides to the debate. There's an article that Adam wrote. Then there's articles that Jason Workmaster from Miller and Chevalier wrote, the Nash and Sabinick report that Professor Nash wrote. Again, you know, the father of all the practice that we do. And, you know, the private bar is on the side of this creates uncertainty and an unwillingness for them to want to enter into any agreements, whereas we, you know, those in the government are, you should have known this when these were not put into the contract and there was no duration.
I mean, the FAR is out there. They can read it as well and see that the something wasn't put in there. Is it, I don't know, I feel like I'm missing that part where, I mean, yes, it's our regulation, we need to be following it, but as another party to agreement that is also then subject to these rules and regulations as well, I feel like that seems a little bit of a weak argument to me.
I think this is where the private bar is being very wishful as to the amount of discretion that a contracting officer has. And how the private bar wants to have broader discretion for the contracting officer, and we're kind of getting that with the revolutionary FAR overhaul, and it creates the sort of tension of how far can a contracting officer go with broad discretion? But if there's limitations with what they can do with the FAR, that's where you run into the inherent issue, you know, the rules rubbing against each other, where yes, we want to enter this into this agreement. We think it'll make the business practice better. It'll make our relationship working under this contract better. But we can't do that because we're limited by the FAR. To me, I think the private bar should understand those limitations. It was right there in front of them. And they should have known that when they entered into this agreement that it wasn't going to last forever. Somebody would have figured it out.
And I'm sympathetic to that, man. But what about the argument that, you know, there are other areas in which the courts or boards have applied some sort of equitable remedy in favor of either the contractor or the government in some cases? Is that just not available here? Did the court or the board discuss what this could have been called or anything like that?
So it did. And this is where I think we really have to kind of dig into the clear facts of the case. And I believe it's actually far more limited than the private bar is making it out to be. And the discussions I've had with Jason, a Workmaster, and some of these other folks in the private bar over what they think, because they think this is a, seem to think this is, you know, every agreement is now fair game. This was a very limited decision. This was a very specific provision of the FAR. The contracting officer invoked that authority expressly. And then if you're going to invoke authority, you follow by the rules of it. And that's just the way that the FAR is set up. Contracting officers do not have unlimited discretion. And we see that, and I cite too in my article, a couple of different cases where protests are overturned regularly because a contracting officer did not follow the FAR. Well, that effectively means that award was illegal. And an award of a contract is a contract that is invalidated by a court. That's pretty similar to what happened here. We have contract claims brought by the government that are invalidated because a contracting officer did not follow a mandatory provision of the FAR. As Dana said, these contractors have very expensive, very well-paid attorneys that are very smart people. They are capable of reading the FAR, and they are nonetheless choosing to take on the risk that the government is not going to say, hey, we didn't follow that, and so we're going to invalidate that. And that is, in my opinion, no different than the GAO or COFC or the ASBCA or the Federal Circuit reversing a contract award or invalidating a government claim against a contractor. Because like, hey, if you're not going to follow the rules, then you don't get the benefit of it. That's how the rules are written. Yes, there is more discretion being granted to contracting officers. Yes, there is some scope of discretion. But the operative facts here is nobody actually disagreed that those requirements were actually not incorporated into it. Nobody disagreed. The APA actually says that the government considers Pratt & Whitney's cost accounting practice to be non-compliant. Those facts were never in disagreement. Okay, that is different than where facts are in dispute here in a different case. And that's why I personally feel this is actually going to be a very constrained case where it's going to be limited to only instances where there is a clear example of the government didn't follow the rules and the contractor agreed to it. Okay, then everyone's taking on risk. And that's what businesses do. And I feel like they're wanting to have their cake and eat it too. They want to have the benefit of the bargain and saying, all right, government, I want you to agree to something you don't have authority to do, and then I'm going to complain wherever someone comes along later on and says, no, we really should be following the rules. All this case really affirms, in my opinion, is that the government contracting officers are required to follow the FAR, and they are limited to the four corners of their warrant.
And if they step outside, it's considered a violation of the law, and it's not a valid contract, and whatever was agreed to is taken out of the contract. And there's case law from the Federal Circuit, from the Boards of Contract Appeals that discuss where contracting officers cannot violate the law, cannot violate the FAR. You can't have contract formed on an illegal basis.
Sir, ma'am, is this a long-term win or a short-term win for the government? I understand that the actual decision does not really go into the $213 million claim that the KO had against the Pratt & Whitney.
No, it doesn't. And being that decision, that claim was issued in 2013, 13 years ago, it's probably gone up a bit since then. And so...
You think?
it is a win in the sense of, yes, now we have a little bit of finality to that particular aspect of it. And now they can actually get on to dealing with the quantum and a little bit more of the merits of it. It's going to keep going for quite a while. This is one step in what I suspect will be many more years of litigation. It's unfortunately very painful, and who knows, maybe we'll all be retired by the time this litigation gets resolved in a number of years. But it's just one of these things of, it's a positive step. It brought some clarity to an issue. And in my mind, it is a win overall for the government because it reinforces the fundamental rule. Contracting officers do not have unlimited discretion. They are bound to follow the rules along with everybody else, and that they do not get free rein to just do whatever they want to.
I agree. This is not the end of Pratt & Whitney. This may be just for this one issue. Other than the parameters on a contracting officer's authority, I think it's also good decision to remind all of us to keep engaged with our contracting officers, make sure that we understand what they are doing, review their agreements. Whether you're a private bar or you work for the government, you need to know what your contracting officers are doing because you're going to see it again in litigation.
You will see it again in litigation. Good to know.
You will see it again in litigation.
So what is the big takeaway from this case?
The big takeaway from this case is a contracting officer's authority is not unlimited, and an illegal agreement is an illegal agreement, and it can't be enforced.
Thank you so much for coming here today to talk about this case with us. It is always good to know what decisions are happening out there in the field. So again, thank you for joining us today in this episode of Far and Beyond. Please make sure to follow us and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. We'd love to hear from our listeners. Please continue to reach out to us on Facebook and LinkedIn. The information can be found in the show notes from today's episode. The views expressed today are those of the presenters, not that of the Judge Advocate General Corps, the Department of the Army, the Department of the Air Force, or the Department of War.